Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. My name is Bob Gizzardi. I'm a member of the Board of Governors of Middle East Forum. I'm from Philadelphia. I am very, very dazzled by this glittering audience that we have today, and I think that our speaker is going to meet all your expectations. I'd like to take a moment to thank our hosts, the law firm of Milberg Weiss, and particularly Mel Weiss, for sponsoring us. And if I could ask the mobile phones be turned off as a courtesy to our speaker, I would appreciate it. And Middle East Forum Director Daniel Pipes will moderate the question and answer period following the formal presentation. Our speaker is Dr., if I'm pronouncing this right, Kidhir Hamza. He is the highest ranking Israeli scientist ever to, is Iraqi scientist, I'm sorry. Pardon me. Sorry. The highest ranking Iraqi scientist ever to defect and live to tell about it. And that live to tell about it is a very dramatic statement, but I think it is very accurate. I'm getting a signal to raise my voice, so I'll raise the volume a bit. He was born in 1938 in Iraq. He received a master's degree from MIT, followed by a PhD in theoretical nuclear physics from Florida State University in 1968. And as you'll see from his book, that was because Florida State obtained a new nuclear accelerator. He was quite the state-of-the-art education in the United States. He was summoned back to Iraq when Saddam Hussein was in power, and at certain threats to his own family, particularly his father. Dr. Hamza joined the Iraqi nuclear effort in 1972 and made a rapid ascent through the ranks. In 1987, he was Director General of the Nuclear Weapon Program, which made him Iraq's leading nuclear physicist. Through his long years laboring for Saddam Hussein, Mr. Hamza dreamed of freedom again. And finally, in August of 1994, he had his chance and escaped through the north of Iraq. Although refused admission to the United States for a year, he was eventually allowed in, soon to be joined by his wife and three sons. He now lives in Washington, D.C., where he is a consultant. Many of you may have read the New York Times Magazine profile of Dr. Hamza in October 2000. He's the author of a fascinating new book about his experiences, Saddam's Bomb Maker, with Jeff Stein, Scribner 2000. Yes, I will. I just started on the way up to New York on the train. I started to read this book. It is fascinating. This is a Hollywood thriller, but what Hollywood only pretends to be, Dr. Hamza has actually lived. This is really an exciting story, has insights on American society that are very, very interesting, and it is a real page-turner. And I highly recommend it. I think we're having extra copies here, and Dr. Hamza has agreed to sign some of the copies if you're interested in it. But it is a very, very exciting book. If you start to read it, you can hardly believe it. It seems like one of the Robert Ludlum type stories, but this is for real. So with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Hamza. I am sure that this is going to be a very exciting discussion. Dr. Hamza?
I wish to thank Mr. Price and Ileana for arranging this meeting. Whatever is in the book, no need to go over it again. The book ends when I arrive to the States. Ileana, then what is the use of this? Okay. Now, this way? Okay. So I thought I'll pick up where the book ended, and that is what happened after. But I'll give preliminary thought to what happened before. Initially, when I went back to Iraq, there were three or four nuclear physicists really in the country. We had two types of educations education in Iraq for those who were educated abroad. Those who were trained in the Soviet Union, ex-Soviet Union, mostly Marxism, Leninism, they were just given degrees and sent back to Iraq without really the prerequisites of their fields. And as such, they were just put aside. They are very useful now. They were sent back to Russia, to front for Iraq, open all kinds of front companies, purchase arms, do all kinds of stuff. I met some of them in 1990 when I went to Moscow. And the others are mostly either European-trained or U.S.-trained. The U.S. is unique in its graduate education program. It is the only country where it keeps testing the process and it keeps checking on the student throughout the graduate program. Mostly Germany, France, others, they just leave the student be, just give him the courses and let him learn what he can on his own. Here, no, he's tested all kinds of exams, then the thesis. So they are the reliable guys. When they go back, almost all the hierarchy, upper hierarchy of atomic energy was U.S. trained then. As I mentioned in the names in the book, they were all U.S. trained. So I am one of two or three U.S. trained nuclear physicists back in Iraq. The 1967 war demoralized the Arab region, and this is the chance for Saddam to pick up the ball and be the new Arab leader. And how can he do it? The way he thought it, to build up all kinds of weapons of mass destruction and build Iraq as the Arab warrior, build Iraq as a military base. We thought at the time, naively, when I first went back, that what we'll do is probably eventually, not immediately, give him the bomb or do a bomb program for him. And one day when we sit on the peace table with Israel, we'll have some cards on the table and we'll get better terms. But we were very naive. This is not what he wanted. Israel is a tool for him, is a way to gain power in the region. And what he wanted is total domination of the whole region and turning it into a military camp of some sort. All kinds of struggles were declared at the time with the West, with the imperialism, with the Zionism, with the Islamic militants, with all kinds of wars being declared, verbal wars and later real ones. Gradually it emerged that when he invaded Kuwait in 1990, within a month we were put on notice to start a crash program to build one nuclear bomb. And that bomb, we were not told what it would be used for. As I mentioned in the book, we built him something 4 feet wide, a ton and a half, too cumbersome to carry into a missile warhead, untested, unhardened, so you don't know if it will stay together or fall apart when a missile makes its trip. And but we were terrified. We knew what is the target. It's clear. He is not going to drop it on U.S. forces for the simple reason it is not wide enough area. Our missiles were not precise enough for that. Though he did manage to hit with a couple of missiles some troop camps in the Saudi desert, but this is not his real goal. We knew his real goal would be Israel, and we knew what would the answer be. The answer B would be destruction, complete destruction of Iraq. Also, the thing didn't make sense. He invaded Kuwait to regain it as part of Iraq. Then he went ahead and started pillaging Kuwait, kidnapping its people, killing its citizens, destroying oil wells. You don't do that to your own country. I mean, if you do that to your own country, I mean, what kind of future does it have? Of course, he did that also in Iraq in the north. He did it in the south. So it is nothing new to us. By that time, I mean, it was clear that this is a game we cannot play anymore with him. And I had to find a way out, and I did leave. Now, what is left? and where is it now? There is a new, a unique probably experience now in terms of you have the new situation where many states like Iraq, probably Iran, and some in the wings are probably planning and looking what to do next, are trying to create a weapon program without the disadvantages of the international sanction regime, international inspections, international pressures. And Iraq, it looks to me like now found a way. The way is to preserve the nuclear program infrastructure, what Saddam did after the war. He took it and distributed it in something like several dozen corporations, small ones. Some of the corporations rebuilt the power stations, some rebuilt the telephone exchanges. The group I established originally to do enrichment by diffusion rebuilt Al Dora refinery in Baghdad, one of the largest refineries in Iraq. And engineering-wise, if you look at it, a refinery is more like a uranium enrichment plant by diffusion. The piping, the structure, the compressors, the handling of gases, there are many similarities. Actually, they built one in Baghdad, they built one in the north, and built one for Yemen also. So atomic energy is becoming very accomplished. They are not just the guys who failed to make a bomb. They are the guys now who do plants and get them running. So you have more expertise, more working within a time frame, more working to achieve a goal and achieve it actually. So you have a more accomplished group. And they remain there. The group that was sent to the oil ministry stayed there. The group that went to the electricity board rebuilt the power station stayed there. So they have now their own individual structures within the various government organizations. Now, the U.S. want to get the inspectors back. What would the inspector see? Where is the program? The program now is split in something like 100 units, and that goes for the biological and chemical weapons, by the way. It splits something like 100 units embedded to within various government organizations like the military. Of course, by now we reach the conclusion that the whole thing is futile, the future of the region is going down the drain with it, all resources are going into a meaningless weapon program, and there is just no future for anybody there. And many people arrived at this conclusion. Nobody is going back. Brain drain is at its maximum right now. Everybody is leaving. And the whole region is going down because of the situation there. Now, suppose an inspector goes back. I bought a computer in 1987 from England for the bomb design. Inspectors now tell me that computer right now is sitting in a wing of Saddam Hospital, of course everything named after Saddam right now, in Saddam City, in the outskirts of Baghdad. Okay. My assistant, the one who runs the computer now, okay, who was doing bomb design for me and did bomb design after I left, I'm sure, okay, is running that center now. Now, he's also doing seismic prospecting for oil maps. You know, you do some explosions in the ground, they generate some seismic waves, it tells you where are the oil domes underground, and you do mapping to do that. He's been doing that for a while after the war. I mean, he's getting an expert at it. An inspector goes to that center. Okay, of course, now they cannot do unannounced inspections anymore. That's out. Iraq would never agree to that. So it has to be announced. It's announced a couple of days before. All the programs relating to the bomb design are gone. And they will see some seismic prospecting maps, three-dimensional maps. And they'll say, okay, somebody brought them here for show, and the guy is really a bomb designer. And we know he is. He's on the list. And they say, no, I'm not. I'm working really on seismic prospecting. Bring an expert. They will. We'll sit down and talk to him. And he's a real expert at making seismic maps for oil industry. and he'll show them some, and he'll show them contracts with the oil ministry. Now, what is the proof here? The situation will go all over the guys who do casting, metals casting for bomb parts, the guys who do diffusion plants or enrichment plants. The whole program is dissolved now. Now, we come to policy angle. The U.S. now is making it its goal, main goal, to get inspectors back in as if it is the solution. Now, is it? Now, they go back in. What do they find? Now, look at Iran. Iran is part of the chemical weapon convention. They signed it. They did not ratify it so far as I know. I think they did even ratify it. The chemical weapon convention, people are asking Iran, do you have any chemical weapons? They say no. We don't have a single chemical weapon canister or bomb in any form. Now, the onus is on the chemical weapon convention people to find one. Now, suppose they did find one. Well, it's left by mistake since the Gulf War, or since the Iraqi war. Now, suppose in Iraq the situation developed the same. You know where Iraq declares the nuclear weapon program, the official Iraqi government declaration now? That Kamil went to Atomic Energy, Saddam's son-in-law, asked them, are you working on nuclear weapons? That's the Iraqi official story now. The Atomic Energy said, no, we are not interested in developing nuclear weapons. He says, okay, assign me somebody who will do a nuclear weapon program. They assigned me. He mentioned me, the Iraqi government mentioned me by name. That Atomic Energy assigned Dr. Qadir Hamza to Kamil, and he went with Kamil and they started their own nuclear weapon program. Saddam has nothing to do with it. Now, if you believe that story, and you believe the Iranian story, then, of course, everything is all set. So what I'm getting at is if they find something right now, even by accident, it will be that guy doing it without authorization. So the whole thing is pointless. The whole exercise of going back, because the whole thing, the program is rearranged, and the future of the whole region, of course, will follow what happens next. If Iraq can get away with it, then you are looking at a future with arms race, more militarization, more confrontation, more aggressive policies by Iraq and later Iran, and whoever thinks Iraq pose a threat for them could be Turkey. Now, the whole point of making a policy is to achieve an end, a resolution of a problem. Now, we've been saying, for example, that, okay, you have two options to do. Either get rid of the guy, and that's a basic solution to the problem, and really the only solution. Or, and the other option, and the Federation of American Scientists adopted this point of view, and wrote Madame Albright at the time, take away the knowledge base in Iraq. Not the pieces of equipment and materials floating here and there. This can be replaced. A piece of equipment is no big deal in Iraq now. Iraq is very expert right now, has a large group of people who are expert and posing as middlemen, making the front corporations in all kinds of places, getting equipment and smuggling them into Iraq. It has a large operation of that kind. And it's pointless. Okay, so you took away a few pieces of equipment here and there. He can replace them. We said, okay, the second best is take away a scientist. Make it a condition for the removal of sanctions. Of course, he will not accept, but this also will tell the world something, that if he refuses that, then it tells that what he intends to do next. There are several also points that remain in the program and its possibilities. Suppose Iraq did get nuclear, what happens next? The question is, what would he do? Okay, he cannot use it. So some people would say, well, he cannot use it because he knows what the result would be. So it's pointless. So let's forget about it. You know, this is a serious mistake for one reason. First, suppose Iraq get deterrence like Israel did now. And he get this way, he gets the capability to do whatever he wants without serious punishment, like Israel did now. Israel can move and doesn't care what the Arabs do, more or less. It does care to a certain degree, but it knows its inner borders are inviolate. It has the means to defend itself in a serious war. Suppose Iraq is in the same situation. What happens next? Without the use directly of nuclear weapons. Now, already Iraq found itself in a deterrent situation when it declared its chemical weapon capability in 1990, when it threatened to burn half of Israel. Israel could not retaliate. For example, the nuclear weapon program was known then. It was declared, for example, the Der Spiegel exposed the Iraqi work to enrich uranium by using centrifuge, the Iraqi program. There was a lot of assessment here in the U.S. that Iraqis actually embarking on a large nuclear program. But Israel could not hit Iraq like it did in 1981 because it knew Iraq has a large deterrence capability then, which is chemical. It did not know about the nuclear angle, it did not know about the biological, but the chemical was deterrence enough for Israel. Suppose it has a larger deterrence, which is the nuclear. What would happen next? Then you would get more terrorism, more excursions probably into Israel by various terrorist groups, more aggressive action, more threats, and more militarization of the Arab streets, if not the governments. You'll get volunteers into Saddam's various causes in droves. They'll be financed, backed, and Iraq will not be afraid from retaliation. And if you know Saddam and his adventurism and his posture as a warrior, he will just declare all kinds of dire threats for anybody who dare attack Iraq, like he did in 1990. I'll burn half of Israel. Now, suppose he has nuclear weapons. Now, what he do with nuclear weapons is another story. There are two situations, two military postures one can take in this. Either it's called non-weaponized deterrence, which is the doctrine used now by Israel. Israel has not declared its weapon, nuclear weapon capability, did not declare officially how many nuclear weapons it has, like the U.S. did, like Russia did, or ex-Soviet Union did. This is non-weaponized deterrence, but it is deterrence. They let the other side know, one way or the other. Banunu, for example, would be a one way of telling it. Get Banunu out with pictures and diagrams and information, have the Sunday Times take over, bring in a nuclear weapon expert like they did with Banunu and Frank Barnaby, and then he vouch for the credibility of Banunu, and then everybody would know Israel has at least 100 nuclear weapons. That's one way of declaring the capability without the disadvantages of actual declaration, which will bring in the pressures, international pressures, sanctions, and other measures. Israel had that advantage. Its friends can defend it by saying it did not declare its weapon capability. It says we will not be first to bring nuclear weapons into the region and such and such. And at the same time, it has the advantages of defense. Suppose Saddam do the same. He has two options. Either make nuclear weapons, get some of the scientists to leave with information, pictures, whatever, and have them verified. But he will deny the story. He will keep the denial posture, but everybody would know. Israel would know, especially. Iran would know. The other way is, and that's probably more popular in the region, is just to test one. We have plenty of desert in Iraq, and use a desert site already. It's called the desert site, by the way. which is already prepared for a test, a small test. Suppose he does a test. What will happen next? The whole region will transform immediately, especially the Arab world. George Kemp says if Saddam tests a nuclear weapon, the Arab streets will be overjoyed with all kinds of people will demonstrate with joy in the streets, in the Arab streets. There will be enormous pressure on Arab governments to align with him. Arab governments probably, some of them, the weaker one probably, like Jordan, probably will lose control over their actual population. There will be so much force inside. Then you'll have a new situation to deal with. An aggressive state, militarized, okay, with weapons of mass destruction of all kinds, and especially nuclear weapons. Volunteers in droves, they can train them into all kinds of terrorist actions, a more aggressive posture, more skirmishes, and possible war. And this is the future now, it looks like, and many in the Iraqi opposition we talk to think it would be if Saddam were allowed to remain. And I think that takes up my time, or I have still a few minutes. Well, that's, I have to leave it to questions. So, well, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hamza, for this sobering and but realistic account. Let me start the questions by focusing on your first policy prescription. Basically, you've got two, if I understand. One is to get rid of Saddam, and if that isn't going to happen, and I know you don't think the United States is serious about that, then the alternative is to try and attract his scientists to leave the country. You mentioned now that you would suggest an offer that if the scientists leave, the sanctions will be dropped. But in other contexts, you have suggested a unilateral effort by the United States and the West in general to bring out the scientists, such as happened with the ex-Soviet bloc. So my question to you is it necessary to make this a quid pro quo? Is it necessary to offer the end of sanctions, or is it possible simply to implement a policy of attracting scientists?
I mean, complete removal of sanctions and allowing Saddam the full latitude of importing anything he wants, I think should not be considered as an option. I mean, there must be some kind of controls over what he imports. Otherwise, we'll have the whole region going down the drain. Well, you have the following situation right now. Suppose an Iraqi scientist leaves. He goes out. U.S. embassies have a sign all over the region, no Iraqis, please. He cannot get in to talk to an American right now. Okay? Now, the Iraqi opposition is in disarray right now. They have no stations to take people in, check them, vouch for them, get them in contact with somebody who's interested. It used to be that way. In the north, when I left in 1994, there were several groups interested in talking to me and contacting me and helping me. Al-Chalabi was one, the Accord group was the other. In the end, the Accord group succeeded in convincing the U.S. government because a member of the board was a member of the Iraqi Atomic Energy. And they managed to succeed the U.S. government, take me in and bring my family out, which the U.S. government did both, as I explain in the book. Now there is no such option. A scientist, if he goes to the north, to the Kurdish enclave, he'll be met by Saddam's agents all over the region. They'll probably assassinate him or kidnap him and bring him back. He cannot go to Jordan because there is a secret, unannounced, criminal exchange agreement of some sort signed by Tariq Aziz with the King Hussein, the late King Hussein, 1994. And several people were repatriated. Al-Chalabi could tell you here. If he talks here, he could tell you stories about this people. One of them is the secretary of the vice president. He ran away to Jordan and was given back by the Jordanian government. This is a very nice arrangement, very convenient for Saddam. Anybody who escapes, Saddam creates a file saying he stole money or killed somebody or whatever. Give it to the Jordanian government. Now he's a criminal. under the criminal exchange agreement, the Jordanian government is bound to send him back to Iraq. Two agents will be in their cars waiting for him outside the courtroom, take him and never see him again. Who will escape Iraq under such conditions? Why would he? That's why we suggested some formal arrangement for us, an Iraqi scientist. He can live under safely with his family. Now, the situation we are in, where the chief of Iraqi military intelligence, Sam al-Ra'i, left a couple of months before I did, and I did, are no longer there. It's impossible now for an Iraqi scientist to escape with his family or arrange a safe escape if the government doesn't let him. So unless some kind of enticement is made, but I'm saying ahead of time, Saddam will not accept it under no conditions. Immediately after we wrote that article, David Albright at the time worked the sentences and published it, the Iraqi government started calling us human vampires. We want to suck the blood out of Iraq. We want just the weapon scientists. We don't want the others. So the thing is, some kind of solution, resolution to the problem, either weaken the capability, the knowledge base, to make weapon and destroy the region with it, or get rid of him, or some similar solution. The only thing we could come up with at the time is this very weak alternative, which we knew he would not accept, but it would be a bargaining point of some sort. Also, some arrangements should be made to receive Iraqi scientists. I mean, at the time when the Soviets invented the MiG airplane, the Americans advertised, okay, anybody who brings a MiG has $1 million. People did fly. One Iraqi, a relative apparently of one of the officials now in Iraq, did take a plane and go to Israel with it. Others did in other places. There is an enticement, a safe harbor for somebody who goes there, safe haven for him and his family. Somebody will take him in. There's an arrangement. There is no such arrangement right now. An Iraqi scientist who needs, he has to knock all kinds of doors before somebody will let him in. And it's not easy. And there is actually no encouragement for such an action. So unless some framework is made in that direction, the Iraqi scientist will prefer to stay where he is. At least he know what he get there, and instead of going out, and he doesn't know what will happen to him. Like what happened to me, I had to stay a year in danger, out, exposed, my family exposed in Iraq. All stories, all kinds of stories published about me in the Sunday Times and other news media talking about me, and Saddam threatening my family. And who would want to be again in that situation? And maybe it will not resolve as well as mine was resolved. He might get killed, or his family might get slaughtered. So why would anybody go through that again unless some kind of a situation he understands before he goes into it and jump the fence from Iraq?
Makes sense, Richard Grayson?
Richard Grayson, British Television News. The story sounds a bit like being caught between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
And with that in mind, I'd like to ask two short questions. You studied in America, both your master's degree and your doctorate, and then returned to Iraq. And you stayed and worked your way up the chain, actually. And you must have found something quite compelling about Saddam's rhetoric, actually, to work your way up. I'm wondering what that was.
What was what? Saddam's what?
His arguments, actually, his rhetoric.
Yeah. You mean internally or public? I mean between us or public?
Huh? It was something that clearly compelled you.
Oh.
Not only to stay, but to work up the chain. And I'm wondering what that was, what you found so compelling about it. And second of all, you mentioned something about Saddam's successor.
Oh. Initially, the situation when I went into in 1970, it's only 3 years after the Six-Day War, 1967. What we face here is the media coverage of that war. It's a mess. And Arab armies killed and scattered all over the desert, total collapse in Egypt. a total demoralization. Wanting to back in Iraq is a total demoralization. And there's a book by Fuad Jaber, a Palestinian American, actually, of Palestinian extraction, called The Israeli Bomb, Israel and the Bomb. And it told us that Israel is working toward, of course, I had to technically analyze it as I did in the book, and it's not credible at the time, it was too early. But it did state that Israel is going into a future of something like 200 bombs, that's the number he used, within a certain number of years. The PLO did publish that book, translated into Arabic, published it, and everywhere you go, you see it, many copies of it. And Atomic Energy has something like 50 copies in the bookshop, in the library alone. And apparently, they got to Saddam, and the Iraqi hierarchy also, the government, and they believed it, or used it, either. And so the mentality, the setup, mindset at the time was that we had to do something about the situation. Of course, it's not comparable situation. First, Israel is a democracy. It has all kinds of controls and checks and balances over who uses the nuclear weapons. In Iraq, there's only Saddam. And that put us in a different category altogether. The whole concept goes into a different category. But all the same, initially Saddam showed us a different face. More logical. He will sit with us hours. For example, at Atomic Energy, the initial meeting was 2 days meeting. I mentioned in the book, I talk about it. And he'll talk one-to-one with us. Okay, what do you say? The situation is this, that. He told us about the government structure, where the region is going, where Iraq is going, what dangers Iraq faces, including the water shortage and other problems. And, okay, we need to get ready. Okay, so by 1972-73, we started getting ready. I headed an Iraqi delegation to France in 1974 and bought a reactor. And but it started then. When I refused to sign the contract for the Iraqi side, Saddam got mad. The logic is not there. You see, this is the third word again. My idea was that this contract, we are not capable of supervising the French. We didn't know enough. So we bring an outside consultant. I had Lloyd's of London at the time. They do some kind of assurance consulting. Come in and act as a consultant. Okay, it's an international project for the IAEA. Is a party to it. So it is an internationally supervised project, still not secret. And we should get some other people at least to advise us. Nobody to advise you. You do it on your own. You do it by yourself. We ended up with a cracked walls, cracked foundation for the reactor. Okay, we cannot tell the French a thing. So gradually, the experience we went through with foreign companies working in Iraq in this type of project is that the companies know the game, and they can play tricks on us and cannot do a thing because Saddam is so mindset, so single-mindedly wanted this thing soon. We had no leverage with anybody. We had to accept anything offered to us. Gradually, we started getting disenchanted with the way things are done. We are dealing with a different... This is not the U.S. These are not an administrator here. Even if he does not have a degree in physics, he knows how to manage a technological advanced project. There, you deal with Saddam. Saddam is the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission. And he doesn't want to understand. The letter to him has to be one page. Everything has to be one-liners. You cannot make points more than one line to him. He has no time. He discussed with you the easy years of 1972-73 were gone by then. You sit with him 2 minutes, or standing. He talks to you in a minute or two, do this and that and that. And he turns his face away. You have to leave. It's not, the camera, the earlier camera view was gone. We got gradually into a military, very obtuse way of doing things, really, actually, very hostile situation gradually developed. And when Al-Sharistani and Ja'far al-Abid, he jailed them and tortured them. Ja'far was jailed and tortured for 20 months, Al-Sharistani for 11 years. And we were the three top scientists in the project. Two of us were down in jail. I was left alone. So gradually it fell off. Gradually we became a little bit more formal. And we believe, I believe, and I also in the book a little bit indicated it, that this was the downfall of the project. We did not give him a bomb. At least Ja'far and the enrichment angle. He did not have his heart in it. This is not the situation in Israel or other countries who did, democracies who did nuclear weapons. Not even in Russia. I mean, when we talked to Salam, the Pakistani Nobel laureate, he said the Russians had a lot of leeway with Stalin. Actually, Khrushchev, when he was given the authority to start a nuclear weapon program, had a lot of leverage on what to do. We did it. We were highly restricted. So gradually the project fell because of its bad management. The IAEA will tell you that. Now this is the evaluation of the IAEA also. It's bad management in the end that got the project bogged down in minor technical problems. Successor to Saddam, I believe, is Qusay, his younger son. A bit about Qusay, I was taking my son, he's about the age of my son, my oldest son, Sufiras. I took my son to school, where Qusay used to go. And one of the teachers, I knew, a friend of mine, took me aside. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm trying to register my son here." He says, "Come with me out." He took me out. He says, after every class, for some reason or the other, if he is mad, he'll take a razor and go on the stairs up. You know, all the classes are on the second floor, administration and halls are in the meetings rooms are on the first floor. So he'll hold the stairs, and every student who comes down the stairs, he'll tear his face with a razor. He said, "Why you put your son here?" I took my son out and sent him to another school. This is going to be the heir to Saddam now. Qusay, his younger son. So you have this situation developing in Iraq. It will be more murderous, mindless type of government. He's even worse than his father, if that's possible. Sorry.
Again, Steve.
Dr. Adnan, I've had the pleasure of reading your book. I'm concerned about a statement that Mosi made here last month. He said that Iraq is maybe couple of months away from having a nuclear bomb capability, or they were short of was hard enough to address a few questions. First of all, does Iraq have a fissionable material for the bomb? What kind of trigger are they using, and what is the current relationship of the Iraqis with the Kurdistan and their spin-offs and the Poles and their spin-offs?
The first one, which spin-off?
Kurdistan, for
instance. Oh, Kurdistan.
And the Polish
institute. Yeah. No, we used to have a lot of visitors from Kurdistan Institute to Iraq. Even they were surprised that the level of terror we are living under. Imagine that during the Soviet era. There is a BND report, the German intelligence report, which was published, I believe, a month or 2 months ago. It was summarized, I believe, in the Sunday Times also of London, and the Israeli Haaretz. I mean, I would take parts of it as correct, others are not. And it gave the same estimate I gave to the New York Times, originally in 1998, and I gave recently also in other interviews. New York Times and others. And it is, once the eyes are lifted off Saddam, he needs 3 years to build his infrastructure back again. He can get equipment back imported to Iraq. He can smuggle them in. There's no problem to that. There are hundreds of oil tankers going every day to Jordan, returning empty. Who's going to go into inside an oil tanker and check what goes back into Iraq in it? And, okay, millionaire, all right, I'll try. You hear me now? No? Okay, suppose now, what you have the situation in Iraq now, you have, if you go to the Turkish border, you have something like 10, 20 miles of trucks every day. Come to Iraq, they bring various stuff, food stuff and some equipment inside, load up on oil and go back, mostly oil products, gas and stuff like that. You have them to Jordan, you have tankers in hundreds every day, go to Jordan and load. I heard even some of them were cut. If the equipment is important enough, there are shops in Jordan where they cut part of the tanker, put the instruments in, and weld them back in again, and put some dirt and stuff like that to make it look like an old... Now, against this system, what use is putting... I left the other day when I read that they are putting inspectors on the border. I mean, what inspectors? What are you talking about here? What would he look for? Okay, I mean, and don't forget, this is a corrupt region. I mean, for money, you can get anybody to let anything go. Okay, now, the program now, I believe the BND, when they estimate that Iraq could have between 3 and 5 weapons in 2005. That's a good estimate. Iraq has now 12 tons of natural uranium and 1.3 tons of low enriched uranium. Between them, this is enough for 6 bombs. So Iraq, if it does not import any more uranium, use what it has already, it can have at least 4 bombs out of that, including, say, some waste and some inefficiencies in the system. So the estimate from this angle is correct. This is what I originally gave the New York Times, and I believe... Iraq now is already in the, has already embarked after the inspectors left. Saddam 7 months ago met with the Iraqi atomic energy people on TV and ordered them openly to do their national duty. Now, if the order came openly 7 months ago, then the real order probably was at least 2 years ago. So Iraq already is in this process. And if you look at several other possibilities, including that Iraq already declared that it perfected the diffusion method, and the bottlenecks in the diffusion program has already been carried through, especially the barrier. Diffusion is a simpler method than the presumed other methods, such as electromagnetic or centrifuge. It has no moving, very few moving parts. It's just simple tubes and compressors and a barrier, and you can have an enrichment plant. I already designed before I left, and David Kay, when he got the big box in Iraq in that parking lot, got one of my reports of diffusion calculation. I did the diffusion calculation for the program originally. We did design and calculate small cascades. You could put them in a bunker, a small bunker. So Iraq could split the diffusion program into that dozen or so sites, and even if you catch one, it doesn't mean much. So Iraq has the capability, it has the infrastructure now to go into, and by 2005, the only thing wrong with the German BND report is that they said the Iraqi nuclear complex is in Qaim, which is on the Israeli side of the Iraqi border. Saddam would not do that. This is an extraction, uranium extraction site. And the other parts of the program are somewhere else.
So the actual time frame of having an actual bomb is
Yeah, probably within 2 years he'll have one, and within 3 or 4 he'll have the rest. Once he gets set, he'll have the rest.
You indicated within 3 years of the ending of the sanctions there could be a bomb. Mm-hmm. The sanctions ended in August of 1998, or the inspections ended in 1998. So we're almost there.
Yeah, we're almost there.
Implicit in the first question, perhaps you didn't quite understand, was implicit in the first question was the assumption that you were in some way attracted to Saddam Hussein's regime and you were enthusiastic for it and therefore rose up to higher and higher positions. Could you address that question?
As I said, initially it was a much more amiable system. I didn't know Saddam, I mean, initially. And we were looking at it as a state project. This is a state security project, like anywhere else. And we were assigned the job of trying to bring that project into fruition. And but besides, the type of government we have did not expose itself to us till much later, till the Iran-Iraq war and later. What we had is really more or less a more amiable system, more nationalistic than others, and more control. But we didn't see much wrong with that at the time. So the relation evolved, actually. Initially, yes. Initially, we came in more or less on our own. We accepted the challenge, and we went into it without too much push, actually. Because we thought, okay, we'll give Iraq some kind of parity with Israel. Eventually, nobody would use it. We'll use atomic bombs. Where? Doesn't make sense. Why? So just eventually give him a few bombs. I mean, all you need to really have parity with Israel. Israel might need 100 bombs, but all we need is 3 or 4. Israel is concentrated in 3 population areas, and all you need really is 3 bombs. And that's it. And that's your policy. Once Israel knows you have it, that's it. And then the balance is there, and the balance of terror is there, and nobody would use it on either side. And that's that. And that's what we thought initially. And then gradually, it's not an really admiring Saddam, it's more or less an acceptance of the challenge he gave us initially. But then we understood that that's not the challenge. The challenge, Saddam wanted to be an emperor of the whole region. Saddam wanted to spread his terror everywhere. And Saddam's terror did not really show itself till much later. Then it is out for us.
Last question. Joe Skelly?
Yes, if I could just ask very briefly, what specific policy recommendations you might make the Bush administration for eliminating this threat in the region of the
United States? When I left in 1994, initially I joined Al-Chalabi. He assigned me a house, a driver, a car, and all that. And I used to see him on a regular basis. There were CIA observers earlier who observed the skirmishes with the Iraqi army. Al-Chalabi has some kind of tattered army, badly equipped, badly trained. More or less the refugees from the Iraqi army who came in. He accepted them, paid them sporadically, not regularly. But they have enough food to eat and some kind of setup to live under. But the strange thing was, this tattered army, in every skirmish with the Iraqi army they won, the reason is nobody fooled them. Here you have a hungry army at the other side, without food, without water. If you read my book, you'll see what we gave them is water, really. Not much food. Water and money, that's all we gave them to allow me to cross. They had no water. They were sitting on top of the mountain for days without anybody even bringing them water. Well, cars are in disrepair. And really, they were not used for supplies. They were used only for war purposes, for military activities. And nobody think of really what these poor guys sitting up the mountain are living on. So now you have these guys stranded on this mountain, conscripts, all of them. You have no volunteers there. If a volunteer comes in, I mean, it's really a forced volunteerism of some sort. Okay, he's sitting on top of the mountain for years. I mean, my brother was 9 years in the army, and he's a doctor. Okay, they conscripted for years. Their salaries are stolen by their officers. They have no money. Whatever money they get has to be from their families. They have no food, very little food, if any, no water, no new clothing, shivering during all winter. And here is this savior coming to fight them. Why should they fight him? They drop their arms and surrender in droves. The problem is feeding them. The problem becomes for the fighting entity that fights them, can they absorb so much these droves of army and is coming into their folds? The problem for Al-Chalabi was, can he take them in and feed them? Most of the time he just sent them back. Now you have the situation the same. What remains, the current situation is more of the same of the old. Saddam did one mistake because he's holding the Iraqis as hostage to his demands. He has to impoverish them some more, make them hungrier, make them sicker, so that the international community will take pity on them and remove sanctions. That's the trick. But the other side of this is, if you fight them, they'll come to your side. They are sick of it. They have no food. Rations are actually reduced with the oil export. Oil is exported in billions and are sitting in UN accounts unused. And Saddam goes ahead and reduces the Iraqi food portions, rations. He used to sell rations for pennies, I mean, for nominal prices, very nominal price every month for each family. Each member of the family has so much food stuff. He reduced it instead of increasing it. There is less medicine. There is less supplies for the average Iraqi. Hospitals are in total disrepair now. Now, why would any Iraqi in that situation go ahead and fight the opposition? If they come in, especially with U.S. support, and that's important. That's critical now. He will not surrender. I mean, they surrendered to Chalabi because it was known that he was backed by the U.S. Okay, and when he was not backed by the U.S. in 1996, Saddam invaded and nobody fought the Iraqi army. The Iraqi army went in and arrested and killed members of the Iraqi opposition. If it is backed by a big power, by the U.S. especially, and they know, okay, if they surrender to the other side, it is the U.S. on the other side. The Iraqi opposition, but backed by the U.S. There is food and medicine there, and there is shelter, and there is safety. Who is going to fight? They didn't in 1994 when I was there. Why should I now? Situation is even worse. So that's one possible solution. Actually, it is not. Some people are ridiculing the proposal floated by some members of the Bush administration that we go after Saddam. It is not that out of range proposal as you might think. Saddam is not the monster he was. He was monster. He's a monster personally, but his armies are not the hardcore army it was. Scattered units now mostly, except for the special Republican Guard, which he keep for himself to save him, his own neck. The others really are not that highly disciplined, tight, highly loyal army. No longer that. It is if you establish an enclave in the south and an enclave in the north, that would be good enough starting point to get Saddam army in and use them to fight Saddam. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much. This is an important testimony, as I'm sure you all agree, both in terms of the human side and in terms of policy. I urge you to find out more by reading the book. We do have a small supply here. Dr. Hamza has consented to sign the books. And I very much urge you to read it. It is a first-hand insight of importance. I'd like to thank our hosts again, Norbert Weiss, and to ask you to put your tags on the desk on the way out, to remind you that in exactly a month from today, the 2nd of May, we'll have Gershom Gorenberg, the author of also a new book, The End of Days, which is about the Temple Mount in Jerusalem and the varying religious expectations about